I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. Last week, President Obama announced that the U.S. would keep almost 10,000 troops in Afghanistan through most of 2016 and maintain 5,500 in 2017 after he leaves office. This reverses a policy he outlined a year ago and is in response to escalating violence in the country, including the attack on Kunduz by Taliban militants who held the city for a few weeks. Joining us from Kabul, Afghanistan, is Jennifer Glass. She's foreign correspondent for Al Jazeera. In fact, has lived in Kabul for the last 4.5 years. And Jennifer Glass, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Marty, it's good to be here.
Is there public support for President Obama's decision last week to keep the troop levels at about 10,000?
Well, the government certainly welcomed it. Not only did they welcome it, they actually had asked for it. President Ashraf Ghani said it came after months of consultations. And we know that the CEO, Abdullah Abdullah, actually had it in a sidebar at the UN General Assembly last month, had made the request again. But we've been speaking to Afghans not only here in Kabul, but up in Kunduz, the city that the Taliban held for a couple of weeks late last month and early this month. And they're not necessarily thrilled with the idea. They say, what will 10,000 troops do that 100,000 troops couldn't do? Some of them say they would rather than keeping foreign forces here, that the Afghan forces be better equipped, better trained, give them heavy weapons. And some of them say more time should have been invested in the peace process. And of course, there's a concern that having American troops here will attract more Taliban attacks. So we haven't seen a lot of enthusiasm from certainly the Afghans that I've spoken to. Some are very relieved. Some feel that it does give the Afghan forces some more breathing room, but it's a very mixed picture here.
President Obama said that the U.S. will not allow Afghanistan to be a haven for terrorists. And at the same time, we hear that the Taliban has not only returned, but the numbers are greater than they were in 2001. Jennifer, can you get us up to speed on that?
Well, I'm not sure the numbers are greater. They certainly control more areas than they did in 2000 or since. They've controlled more areas than they have since 2001. Obviously, in 2001, they controlled basically the whole country. But since 2001, the fighting we've seen this year, and the fighting season usually spans from the spring until about now, until the fall, we've seen not only fighting in their strongholds, so along the eastern border with Pakistan and in the south, Kandahar, which is their traditional heartland, but in the north. And I think that took everybody quite by surprise. Kunduz was where they launched their spring offensive in April, and the fighting has been going on up there basically all summer. Now, the Taliban have had a number of districts outside of the city, but the fall of Kunduz City on September 28th was really a big blow. That was the last Taliban stronghold to fall in 2001, and the fact that they could go in and take the city has many Afghans nervous. We're also seeing very heavy fighting in the south in Helmand province. There, of course, where American and British forces fought so hard for so long and was the focus of the surge in 2010, 2011, and 2012. And we're also seeing fighting in the northeast in Badakhshan along that corridor and in many other areas in the country. There was a big firefight today in the west of the country in Herat province. In Shindan, near the Afghan Air Force's biggest base, that was repelled. But the Taliban are definitely keeping the Afghan security forces very busy, and the Afghan security forces are taking very heavy casualties.
Well, and to focus on Kunduz, that got so much attention when the Taliban were able to take and hold the city for a couple of weeks. You've been there. What does it look like now?
Well, there's a lot of destruction in the city center. Things are getting back to normal. There are cars on the streets. Shops are opening, but with much difficulty. A lot of shops were looted. Many shops were burned. Of course, the terrible attack on the main hospital there was a huge blow. That was an American attack on the Doctors Without Borders hospital there. That was the only trauma center in the region. Last year, it treated 22,000 Afghans. And now if anyone gets hurt in fighting, basically they have to travel a couple of hours down difficult roads. The Taliban have left the city, but they are still in surrounding districts, as they have been for quite a long time. The Taliban have kept districts up there for several years, so it has always been kind of a difficult area, but never did they threaten Kunduz City like they have this year. So even though Afghan security forces are back in charge of the city itself, there's a lot of concern about the roads leading in and out, and the Taliban saying basically they withdrew basically to conserve their fighters, to prevent civilian casualties, and to make sure that they were ready for any kind of future operation.
The U.S. is doing an investigation, or I think several investigations, about the bombing of this Doctors Without Borders hospital. Are there also investigations going on in Afghanistan about what led to this obviously terrible mistake?
There are three investigations right now: NATO, a U.S. military investigation, and a joint U.S.-Afghan investigation. However, Doctors Without Borders is not happy about that. They want to see an independent investigation. They've asked the Independent Humanitarian Fact-Finding Commission, which is an independent commission based in Switzerland, to look into it. But that needs the consent of both parties, the Afghans and the Americans. And we understand that the United States is definitely resisting, saying that three ongoing investigations will be adequate. And the Afghans backing them up, really a sign of how much this administration is backing up the Americans, as opposed to the previous administration here of Hamid Karzai. Whenever there was an American airstrike, he lashed out at the Americans. And here we've actually seen President Ashraf Ghani, and today his acting defense minister, Masoom Stanikzai, really defending the Americans in this. It is a very sensitive subject, but we haven't seen any sort of public outpouring of anger over the attack on that hospital on October 3rd, which lasted more than an hour and destroyed the hospital and killed 22 staff and patients. Now, we've seen some preliminary results from the Afghan investigation about what happened in Kunduz, and we're hearing from Afghan officials that it was a failure of intelligence, that the Taliban were able to infiltrate the city, and that's how they were able to help take it over. It was also a holiday weekend, a big holiday here, Eid, when they took over the city. So right now, preliminary results are saying the fall of Kunduz, at least, they're attributing to a failure in Afghan intelligence.
Let me ask you about the president of Afghanistan, President Ghani. What is he's only been in office for about a year. What is the public opinion about him so far? What's the view of Afghans of their president?
Well, you know, there's a lot of disappointment. There was we had a very, very long presidential election season last year. The stalemate lasted about 6 months. And President Ashraf Ghani is ruling alongside his political rival, basically the man who came in first and second, and there's debate over who came in first and second because of allegations of corruption, are now ruling alongside each other. Ashraf Ghani is the president. Abdullah is now the chief executive. And they are ruling in a so-called national unity government. So some people really feel that that's very unsatisfactory, that they have two presidents. It's a deadlock. It took 6 months for them to agree on a cabinet. There's still only an acting defense minister. There's been a lot of infighting over at the presidential palace. And people, though, after having waited, had high hopes for Ashraf Ghani, that he would be able to do what he promised. He promised he would fight corruption. He promised he would try and make Afghanistan self-sufficient. And while he's made a lot of progress in that area, the economy is still terrible. Now, that was always going to happen this year because hundreds of millions of dollars in international aid is gone. And, of course, the withdrawal of many international troops took away a big section of the economy. Now, Afghanistan's still dependent heavily on international aid, and Ashraf Ghani is working to change that, but he knows it's going to take decades for Afghanistan to stand on its feet, and Afghans are running out of patience.
President Obama described him as and I'm quoting here, a serious partner who wants our help. Certainly a very different kind of relationship than the one that Karzai had, I guess, late into his tenure as president of Afghanistan.
Absolutely. That is very clear. And not only in the aftermath of the airstrike on the Doctors Without Borders hospital, but also in the fact that Ashraf Ghani and Abdullah Abdullah have been reaching out to the United States. We know that they wanted the troops to remain here. They understand that, that Afghan forces really need U.S. forces alongside. So the 9,800 American forces that are here have two roles. One of them is a counterterrorism role, and those forces are directly under U.S. command. And then the other half of them are under the NATO umbrella. But basically, Afghan security forces need help with intelligence, with logistics, with air support. The Afghan Air Force is very fledgling and very small, as well as command and control. One of the big complaints about Kunduz is that there were a lot of forces there. There were a lot of Afghan security forces there in place, but not a lot of coordination between the Afghan army, the Afghan police, the Afghan special forces. And that was a contributing factor to why the Taliban were able to take control of Kunduz City and then hold off the forces for so long.
Jennifer, a couple minutes before we have to say goodbye to you. Billions of dollars have been spent in Afghanistan. Can you see that? Can you see the investment that's been made in trying to rebuild that country?
Well, I was here in 2001. If you saw the place in 2001 and saw it now, there have, of course, been incredible changes. There's power in Kabul basically 24 hours a day. The city is huge. It went from about less than 1 million to 6 million. A lot of people do have access to education. There's definitely more business. But if you look at the kind of money that was spent, corruption is definitely one of the biggest problems that the country faces. President Ghani understands that, and he's trying to rework everything. But it's a very, very uphill battle because people just expect to pay bribes here and there, and it's very, very difficult to eradicate that from the culture right now. So basically, the United States has spent about $33,000 for every man, woman, and child in Afghanistan. Has every Afghan seen that? No. A lot of the rural areas very much left behind. For rural women, life hasn't changed all that much. Still, a lot of the country remains inaccessible. A lot of the country doesn't have power. So when you come from nothing, of course, the progress is astounding. Could we have done more? Could it have been better managed? I think so. And, you know, President Karzai's big complaint was the aid money was just not spent properly, and that's something President Ghani is trying to change. The aid money will go through the government rather than just to projects that Western aid organizations do with an oversight committee. But the idea is that the Afghans will try and get to build things that they want to build things that are sustainable and that will really stay here. And that's the kind of difference that Ashraf Ghani is trying to make here. But again, it is a very, very challenging battle.
Jennifer Glass, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times, getting our conversation started, talking about Afghanistan. Thanks so much and stay safe.
Thanks very much.
And that's Jennifer Glass, foreign correspondent for Al Jazeera, joining us from Kabul, Afghanistan. In fact, she has lived in Kabul for the last 4.5 years. We will continue our conversation with our second guest, talking about President Obama's announcement last week that the U.S. would keep almost 10,000 troops in Afghanistan through most of 2016. And we have Stephen Biddle waiting in the wings. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Last December, President Obama announced that America's combat mission in Afghanistan had come to an end, and he outlined a drawdown of troop levels. Last week, he announced that 9,800 U.S. troops would remain in the country through most of next year to go after terrorists and to aid Afghan forces who were overrun in Kunduz by the Taliban just a few weeks ago. We asked Stephen Biddle to join us. He's a professor of political science and international affairs at George Washington University, also adjunct senior fellow for defense policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. And back in 2009, he served on General Stanley McChrystal's initial strategic assessment team in Kabul. And Stephen Biddle, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. We need to get our guest up and running. Stephen Biddle, I can hear something. We will try to get him squared away here. If you want to join the conversation, and obviously we are talking about Afghan policy, which and the war in Afghanistan, the America's longest war, and the president making a decision he clearly did not want to make, having to do with maintaining a troop level in Afghanistan that he had hoped to take down. To join our conversation here, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is America's longest war into its 14th year. The president was concerned about the country becoming a haven, if not a breeding ground, for terrorism. This pronouncement countered the president's initial campaign promise to end America's foreign entanglements. And it looks like we have Stephen Biddle with us on Radio Times. And nice to have you with us on the show.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Sorry about that rocky beginning. I'm struck by the kind of optimism that the president had almost a year ago, last Christmas, when he talked about, you know, Afghanistan having a chance to build its own country and it would not be a source of terror attacks again. And the much more pessimistic, frankly, almost gloomy announcement that he made last week about maintaining troop levels in Afghanistan. What has happened in the last year?
Well, I think the previous rhetoric was a little over-optimistic. What happened in the meantime to change it, I think, is primarily the fall of Kunduz. I think a lot of people were very surprised that the Taliban were able to take a major Afghan city. They'd never been able to do that ever since 2001. They had typically, when the Mujahideen were fighting the Soviets way back when, they had a very difficult time breaching Afghan government defenses around cities. The pessimistic expectation had long been that the Taliban would come to control the countryside and might even be able to cut communications between cities, but I don't think a lot of people expected a major Afghan city to fall. When that happened, I think that altered assessments of what the Afghan National Security Forces were capable of doing in a lot of places, presumably including the White House.
Well, and that was a real test for whether the U.S. could, I guess, train up these Afghan forces and whether they were able to take on the Taliban that's been in country for years now, fighting for control.
That's right. For a long time, I think there's been a recognition that the Afghan security forces weren't going to defeat the Taliban in some military sense. They weren't going to drive them into accepting some kind of instrument of defeat in a negotiated settlement. But the idea was that the Afghans would be strong enough to hold more or less what they had when the United States handed security responsibility over to them and maintain a stalemate. And the larger strategic logic of the war for a long time has been that the Afghans would maintain a stalemate, and in the meantime, we, the Afghan government, the Pakistani government, and the Taliban would negotiate a settlement. And the way we would come out of this, if we're going to, with our interests intact and with the Afghan government's interests intact, is that there would be some sort of negotiated deal. And in that context, the purpose of the Afghan military was not to win the war. It was just to not lose the war long enough for these talks to unfold. And you know, for most of that time, the usual pessimistic view was that Congress would defund the Afghans before the negotiations were over, and that was seen as the primary threat. After the fall of Kunduz, people's assessments of whether the Afghan military can simply hold the line long enough are changing.
Well, and are there problems created when the U.S. has deadlines, then changes what they're going to do when those deadlines come and go? Obviously, going back to the announcement about drawdown of troop levels and then the announcement last week of having to maintain these troop levels, should the U.S. just stay there and fight and continue this 14-year war, or should the U.S. just go home?
Well, I mean, certainly I've never been a fan of calendar deadlines for a variety of reasons, but in the current context where, again, the only scenario for getting out of this with our interests intact is a settlement. What these announced deadlines do is they delay serious talks. Right. Because every time there's a deadline, that raises the interesting question of will the Afghans be able to hold after deadline X is passed and something changes that isn't good for them? The United States starts to withdraw or finishes its withdrawal or hands over responsibility to them or leaves the country. every time that there's a date announced for one of these things, what that does is it gives the Taliban a reason to wait and see if they can get what they want without having to negotiate a compromise in order to get it. And that just kicks the can further down the field on the talks that are the only serious way out. So my preference at this point would be that we do one of either one of two things. Either we just say we're going to stay with a modest force but indefinitely, or at least we don't give a deadline. Or we just decide that this isn't going to work, we're not going to throw good money after bad, and we simply cut our losses and get all the way out. But this succession of deadlines mostly makes it impossible to secure our interests, but continues to expend resources in the pursuit. And I think that's in many ways the worst of all worlds.
I was thinking of the definition of insanity, which is doing the same thing, expecting different results. So if the U.S. is maintaining this troop level for the next year at least, is there something they can do differently to get the parties to the negotiation table?
Well, the negotiations actually had been making some progress through the course of the summer. The Taliban representatives and Afghan government representatives met twice this last summer, and it looked at the time like things were moving forward. The problem at the moment is the Taliban announced the death of Mullah Omar in July. Omar himself actually expired 2 years before that, as far as we can tell. But they announced it in July, and that led to this leadership struggle within the Taliban, which was always a fractious coalition of factions rather than a kind of a unified, homogeneous entity. So there was this struggle over who would run the thing, and that leadership struggle has basically put the whole negotiating process into a deep freeze, at least until such time as the Taliban sort out in a clear way who's in charge, and in which whoever is in charge, currently Mullah Akhtar Mansour, has developed enough of a secure following that he doesn't need to demonstrate how tough he is by refusing to talk to the Afghan government. Now, there are indications that the Taliban might be willing to renew negotiations once this leadership struggle settles out. Among other things, the Pakistani foreign policy chief has been making noises since September indicating that the Pakistanis would like the negotiations to resume. The Pakistanis have more influence over the Taliban in many ways than we do. So it's not completely crazy to suppose that if you can maintain a stalemate on the ground, you don't need to win, but you just need to keep from losing, then it's possible that you might still get to a negotiated deal. But it's going to take a while, partly because we just announced another deadline at the end of 2016.
We're going to
cut the troop count in half, but largely because the Taliban are sorting out who's in charge.
But if the Taliban, Jennifer Glass from Al Jazeera was describing the Taliban in control of, important and in many ways it seemed like wide swaths of Afghanistan, why would they give that up?
Yeah, and they're not going to give that up in exchange for a settlement that looks like a surrender document. So if there's going to be a settlement, it's going to be a true compromise, meaning that we're going to have to give them something they want in order to make this worthwhile. Now, it's a perfectly plausible argument to suppose that there's nothing we can give them that will be good enough, that's consistent with our interests, that the situation on the ground is negative enough militarily that the Taliban just won't settle for anything short of total victory. The only way to find out is to try through the negotiations. But there are some reasons to suppose that that might be too pessimistic. So, for example, when the Afghan government and the United States indicated interest in negotiating starting a couple of years ago, the easiest thing in the world for the Taliban to do would have been to just say no. Anytime the Taliban indicates that they're interested in negotiating, there are significant parts of their alliance that take this as a betrayal. And moreover, take this as evidence that they can't trust the leadership. And it creates divisiveness and factional strife within the Taliban. And we've already seen that unfolding, in fact. The growth of what's often called an Islamic State presence in Afghanistan almost certainly represents primarily mainstream Taliban that are so opposed to the negotiation initiatives that they're breaking with the Taliban as a whole and are now actually shooting at the Taliban in Afghanistan. all the Taliban needed to do to prevent all of that was just say no to negotiations. But they didn't. They expressed interest, and now they're struggling with the consequences of that. I don't think they would have done that if they weren't at least interested in hearing what might be on offer. The other main reason, I think, why they might be interested in doing this is if they wanted to, they could surely wait us out and win the war militarily. The cliche in the theater is the Westerners have the watches and the Taliban have the time.
That's right.
The trouble is every month that goes by during that process, the U.S. leadership targeting campaign has some chance of killing any given Taliban leader. And in fact, we've killed quite a few. It's not a trivial concern on their part. Whatever you think of the drone campaign and the special forces raids, and I'm personally very conflicted on their utility, one clear advantage they do have is they impose a cost on the Taliban for just waiting this thing out. And I think when you look at their actual behavior, a surprising willingness to sit down and talk, given that that imposes costs on them, and the incentives they have, which include some danger that any given leader won't survive the exercise if this thing goes on another 5, 6, 7 years, who knows. I think what you've got is a reasonable surmise that perhaps the Taliban might be willing to negotiate, and the details are what will determine whether the war gets settled. And I think all that's reason enough that if we're serious about it, like, for example, willing to keep a few thousand troops there without a time limit, there's some chance we could get to a settlement. Not 100%, but some chance. And I think it's worth trying that, if we're serious about it.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Stephen Biddle, the second of three guests in this hour of Radio Times, professor of political science and international affairs at George Washington University. We're talking about Afghanistan back in the news, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stephen Biddle, I don't want to put you in a position of negotiating for the Taliban, but what would that compromise include? We're going to be talking in just a couple of minutes with the head of women for Afghan women, and I think a number of women in Afghanistan are concerned that they would lose some of the rights that they have gained over the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the Afghan government has favored talks for quite some time, but they're quite divisive within Afghanistan for that reason, among others. Right. There are a variety of other political actors in the north of the country in particular that are also worried about possible restraints that the Taliban might impose as a consequence of a settlement. I think the terms of a deal, if they're going to be one, are surprisingly enough relatively clear. The trick is in the details. So any deal, if it happens, for example, is going to require that the Taliban do some things. They're going to have to break with al-Qaeda, they're going to have to renounce violence, they're going to have to disarm, and they're going to have to accept something that can be described as a version of the current Afghan constitution, which sounds like a big ask, but it's actually less than that. The Afghan constitution is a surprisingly plastic document relative to most world constitutions. You can change important elements of it by a majority vote in the Afghan parliament. And that's where the concern over Afghan women's rights comes in, is what, if any, changes in the basic governing documents of the country will the Taliban insist on in the negotiations? I don't think anybody knows yet. That's one of the several places where the details are going to matter a lot.
Yeah.
That's what they would have to do. What the Afghan government would have to do is it would almost certainly have to legalize the Taliban as an allowed political actor in the country. It would almost certainly have to withdraw the remainder of the foreign troops if the Taliban continue to insist on that. And it would have to almost certainly provide some sort of set-aside or guaranteed political foothold for the Taliban in the Afghan government. Some number of ministerial posts, some number of parliamentary seats, or some number of provincial governorships or provincial offices. I think that's the broad outline of what the deal would look like. The Taliban get legalized and get a foothold. In exchange, they give up violence and accept something that looks kind of like the Afghan constitution of today. The warp and woo for the talks will be how big a foothold do they get? What exactly will the set-aside be? And what, if any, changes in the Afghan constitution are going to be required? And those are complicated negotiations. But I think that's the larger architecture of, if there's going to be a settlement, kind of what it would look like.
And let me just quickly reintroduce you. And that's Stephen Biddle. And he's joining us today on Radio Times talking about Afghanistan. And you're listening to WHYY here in Philadelphia. Stephen Biddle, just a couple minutes before I have to say goodbye to you, but there have been some comparisons between Afghanistan and Iraq. The idea that when the U.S. forces left Afghanistan, that allowed ISIS and extremists to begin to take control of the country. Of course, also the government of Maliki complicated things. Are there some parallels between these two countries, or should we think of them sort of each in their own right?
Well, I mean, obviously they're very different places, but there are also some important similarities. The most important of them may be the political optics. I think the White House found it politically embarrassing when Mosul fell, when four divisions of the Iraqi army evaporated, and when a situation that they'd previously described as stable obviously was shown not to be. And I don't think they want to rerun that movie in Afghanistan. There are also some common themes in the underlying causes of the collapse at Mosul and the performance of the Afghan National Security Forces, though there are very important differences by degree.
Yeah.
The Afghan forces are much more capable than the Iraqis were, but there are significant problems of combat motivation in both forces for a similar underlying reason. In poorly institutionalized developing states like Iraq and like Afghanistan, corruption, cronyism, and politicization is often a deliberate strategy by regimes to buy the loyalty of armed groups within the society that might otherwise be a threat to the leadership. And as a result, both the Iraqi military last year and still to this day, and the Afghan military have serious problems of corruption. And when militaries get corrupted and politicized, they have great difficulty generating combat motivation among the troops in the field. And part of the reason why the ability of an Afghan security force that has more than 300,000 people to hold the ground that it now has is so tenuous is because of this question of how much combat motivation can they actually generate. How much of their nominal
strength. I hate to do this to you, Stephen Biddle, only because we are out of time. They're playing my song, and thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure.
Professor of Political Science and International Affairs at George Washington University. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. When the Taliban attacked Kunduz a few weeks ago, among their first targets were shelters and centers for abused women and for children run by Women for Afghan Women. The organization has shelters and centers in some 13 provinces in Afghanistan, considered one of the most dangerous countries in the world for women. We asked Manisha Nadari to join us. She is the executive director of Women for Afghan Women. In fact, just returned from Afghanistan. And Manisha Nadari, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
What can you tell us about Kunduz? So first of all, are your shelters, are your center, is it back open again?
No, the center isn't back open again. We had to, when the Taliban invaded on September 28th, we had to close down our facilities, evacuate our staff and clients because we were on the hit list of the Taliban. So we immediately evacuated everybody, and then the Taliban looted our facilities. They took our cars and our computers, and they smashed everything in sight, all the desks and windows and doors and everything, and they burned down our shelter. So it's going to take us a while to set everything back up and start operating again.
So where are the women and children today, the ones who are at this shelter?
They're all in Kabul. We had to evacuate everybody, our staff and our clients, to Kabul.
And how did you know, or how did you know that your organization, Women for Afghan Women, how did you know you were on the Taliban hit list?
So we've been getting threatening emails, calls, even visits from the Taliban for the past 2 years, telling us to close down our facilities, or you know, to give them some of the women who are in our shelters so they could be stoned to death. For according to the Taliban, they had violated the Islamic law, so they had to be stoned to death. So we knew that. And for the past 2 years, we've been getting warnings from the Afghan security a department saying we are hearing on the grapevine that your organization is on a top target list. So they wanted us to take care of our security, you know, to really be vigilant when we do our work or when we go to the field. So based on those things, we knew that we were one of the top people on their hit list.
Do you have bodyguards? Do you have people who protect you and others who work for your organization?
No, we're a very local organization. We have support of the community, of community leaders, and our staff are very local. They're hired from the local communities. So, you know, we don't want to bring any more attention to ourselves and our work than we already have. So if you have bodyguards, you know, walking around with us, everybody will know that, you know, that we're in danger. So we try to do our work on very grassroots level. So we don't have any of those bodyguards or weapons or anything like that.
Let me ask you what I've asked our other guests in this hour, and this was the announcement last week here in the United States, President Obama saying that at least for the next year, maintaining current troop levels in Afghanistan. And I'd be curious about your response to that. Do you think that was the right decision by the president?
Absolutely. We've been advocating for troops to stay in Afghanistan for a long time now, so I'm glad it finally happened that the president said that troops will stay. That not only helps the Afghan security forces, but it also sends a signal to the Taliban or other terrorist organizations in Afghanistan to say that the U.S. is not leaving right now, that they have the backs of the Afghan security forces and the Afghan government. And it's very important for Afghans to know that the U.S. is going to support them in this fight for the long haul, that they're not going to be abandoned like the Iraqis were abandoned when the U.S. troops left.
There are some questions being raised about why Afghan security forces have not been able to fight off the Taliban. Why do you think that is?
The Afghan security forces are committed to providing security for Afghans. The Afghan security forces are, including the Afghan government itself, is very new. You know, this whole system is less than 13 years old. So they're getting trained, but they're not as trained as we want them to be. They don't have the kind of equipment or weapons that they need to fight off the Taliban. I mean, the Taliban, when they invaded Kunduz, they came with tanks and heavy machinery and heavy weapons. The Afghan forces don't have that.
It's been 13 years since the U.S. First invaded Afghanistan. Has life improved for women in that country?
Absolutely. A lot has changed for women in the country. I mean, everything has changed, let me just say, from schools. You know, before 9/11, there were no girls in school. We now have millions of girls and boys in school. Women are in the government. They're in universities. This past week, Kabul University started a gender program. People can now earn a master's in women's rights and gender in Afghanistan, which is unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Before 9/11, Afghanistan didn't have any systems, no government, nothing. There was no justice system. There was no army. There was no, you know, not a real economy. There were no roads. There was nothing. We now have everything in place. Everything's in place, but it's also new. It's in the infant stages. So we will have growing pains as we go and try to perfect the system. I mean, Afghanistan is a democracy now, and a little over a year ago, millions of Afghans came out and voted at the cost of life and limb. I mean, in the United States, we take voting or elections for granted. In Afghanistan, people knew that if they went out and voted, they could possibly not come back home because they would be killed by the Taliban, or their fingers or hands would be cut off. But they went out and voted anyway because they wanted to make a statement. And that's huge in Afghanistan.
Let me just reintroduce you. That's Manisha Naderi. She's the executive director of Women for Afghan Women. In fact, just returned from Afghanistan, and the organization runs women's shelters, centers for children as well. And just about a month or so ago, when the Taliban attacked Kunduz in Afghanistan, among their first targets were the shelters and center run by Women for Afghan Women. To join the conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY. Radio Times. Manisha, I'm just curious about your thoughts about the government of Afghanistan negotiating with the Taliban. There have been a couple of meetings between Taliban leaders and members of the government. Does your organization, do you support these conversations, these negotiations?
No, we don't. We're totally against any form of negotiations with the Taliban, for the reason, you know, being that they're a terrorist organization. They can't be trusted. Even the things that they say that they're going to do, you can't really trust that they will do the things that they say. And that, you know, we were proven right when the Taliban invaded Kunduz. They slaughtered people on the street. They killed anybody who had anything to do with working outside of the home. If you were working in the government, you were either killed or were going to be killed. If you were working with NGOs, with the Afghan security forces, if you were a school teacher, anybody basically who had a public life outside of the home were attacked. So, you know, we're totally against negotiations with barbarians like, you know, like the Taliban.
But, and this is, you know, this may be an unfair question to you because of what you do for Women for Afghan Women, but I guess the question that I was talking about with the previous guest, which is if the Taliban are making military inroads, then perhaps the only solution is some kind of negotiated solution. Is there another solution that you think preserves the rights of women in Afghanistan?
Absolutely. We don't think that, you know, that negotiations should be done with terrorists, period. The Afghan government should really focus on building infrastructure in Afghanistan. You know, they have to provide jobs to people. They have to provide opportunity, educational opportunities for people. Economics, you know, is everything. If you can't feed your family, if you can't feed your children, the Taliban are paying their the Taliban and ISIS, for that matter, who's trying to come into Afghanistan, who's already controlling some districts in the eastern Afghanistan, are paying their fighters a couple of $100, $300 or $400 per month to fight for them. If you can't feed your family, you're going to be forced to join these insurgent groups. If you had a job where you can feed your family, you know most Afghans don't want to fight. They want peace. They're sick and tired of war. I really think that the answer is, you know, if you provide jobs to people, all these Afghans who are joining the Taliban will not join them, and they will be in their own communities.
We heard from our first reporter who reports for Al Jazeera that the economy in Afghanistan has taken a bit of a hit. I mean, that's true for a lot of countries around the world. But as you said, finding jobs, securing jobs for people is one way to stabilize the country. How does a poor country like Afghanistan do that?
Afghanistan used to be a self-sustaining country. Right. We grew the things that we ate. We didn't import anything. Right now, Afghanistan is importing everything. I mean, everything. Nothing is being built or done in Afghanistan. If the Afghan government restarted the factories or the industries that were keeping Afghanistan self-sustained in the past, if they do that, that's going to help Afghanistan, you know, Afghanistan's economy. The other thing to do is that the world really has to put pressure on Pakistan to stop supporting the Taliban and other terrorist organizations. I mean, people, we have to ask ourselves, where are the weapons coming from? Who's supporting the Taliban? And the answer is it's Pakistan. And the politicians in Pakistan have said in the past that they have and they are supporting the Taliban. yet nobody, the United States or other countries are not putting the kind of pressure that's needed on Pakistan to say, stop this, stop supporting the Taliban.
Well, and the Pakistan Prime Minister Sharif is in Washington, D.C. this week. It sounds like you want the president to deliver that message to him.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It has to. It really has to be a tough conversation. I mean, you can't say that you're fighting terrorism and then supporting Taliban at the same time. That's not the way to do it.
And that's Manisha Nadiri, and again, Executive Director of Women for Afghan Women, the third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. Again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Manisha, the president of Afghanistan, President Ghani, is quoted as saying that women would be included at the right time. That's the quote, at the right time, at the bargaining table. What do you think he meant by that?
Well, whatever he meant is not the right thing to say. What does it mean? I mean, Afghan women are more than 50% of the population. You can't bring peace if you're not including 50% of the population, or if 50% of the population are at its knees. You know, that's just not the right thing to say. You have to include women, not just at the bargaining table, but in everything. In every single aspect of government and life, women have to be included, because unless 100% of the population work for the betterment of the country will not get better.
Do you worry that Afghanistan could return to the kind of country it was under the Taliban? Is that one of your worries?
That's one of my big worries, which is why we were advocating for U.S. troops to stay in Afghanistan for a little longer. I'm really afraid that if the U.S. troops leave, like they left Iraq, that the Taliban will come back, and this time they're going to be more vicious and more violent than they were before. They will definitely kill anybody who has worked for the government or has worked as a school teacher or with NGOs. I mean, they showed what they will do in Kunduz, which is horrific.
I was also reading that sometimes others besides the Taliban have targeted shelters. Is that shelters for women? Is that true?
Yeah, in the past, I mean, the Afghan government, parliamentarians in government are very conservative. In the past, they have advocated or tried to take over shelter and close them down. But we fought them. Through advocacy, and but at the end they backed down. We now have a very willing and supportive partner in the Afghan government. They support all of our work.
And final question to you before we have to say goodbye. So I know you just came back from Afghanistan. Do you know when you might be going back?
Yeah, I might be going back in about a month and a half.
Including going back to Kunduz to see how things are?
Yes. I've sent a delegation to go to Kunduz right now so they can come back and give us a report of what it will take for us to rebuild in Kunduz again. When I'm back in Afghanistan, I will definitely be visiting Kunduz.
Well, Manisha Nadiri, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times, and good luck with your work in Afghanistan.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Executive Director of Women for Afghan Women, the third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the program. Find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We will be right back.